I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Calls to throw the bums out of Washington are nothing new, and a recent refrain to drain the swamp gets at this idea that D.C. politics changes people, and not for the best. A simple solution? Term limits. So says our first guest, Missouri State Representative Chuck Basie, who wants a constitutional convention to change how long people can serve in Congress. Today, we discuss the merits of legislative term limits. Then a conversation with local philanthropist, businessman, and possibly the most prolific board member in town, Bob Rainier. He's helped raise hundreds of millions of dollars for causes all over the metro. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Push is on in Missouri to impose term limits on members of Congress. After all, the thinking goes, the Missouri General Assembly has term limits, so why not senators and U.S. representatives? But getting it done wouldn't be easy because it would involve the calling of a national convention to discuss a term limit constitutional amendment. Nonetheless, the idea is moving, and here to talk about it are Missouri State Representative Chuck Basie. He's a Republican from Rocheport who's sponsoring a bill to get this done. Representative, nice to have you. Good morning. Well,
good morning. How are you doing?
Well, and also with us is Peverell Squire. He's a political scientist at the University of Missouri. Professor, nice to have you back again.
Good to be here.
You know, a recent poll from McLaughlin and Associates concludes that 82% of Americans, regardless of party affiliation, want to see term limits imposed on representatives and senators in D.C. Representative Basie, how surprised are you by this?
Not surprised at all. I actually surveyed my own district about our term limit system here in Missouri, and it's very popular with my constituents. So matter of fact, some of them issued comments on the returns and said they would like to see them a little stricter. So it's very interesting.
Professor Squire, why are term limits so popular? I mean, you know, on one level, they're a pretty negative statement about our representative democracy here.
Well, they do generate generally pretty positive comments from voters. I think the problem with them, of course, is when you take it from the abstract question and put it into a concrete reality, and you ask voters whether, in fact, they want to get rid of their particular representative or somebody else. And then it gets a little more problematic because they may be comfortable with the representation they're getting, and they may not be too thrilled with the prospect of the uncertainty of having to replace that person.
So it's always the other guys who ought to go, but hey, my representative, Professor, he's okay.
Well, that's generally what we find when we look at public opinion surveys. People today, for example, will say that they don't like Congress, but that they're much more comfortable with their particular representative, and that's been a long-term trend.
Well, as most people know, President Donald Trump is also in favor of term limits for Congress. Here's what he said about this during the 2016 campaign.
But there's another major announcement I'm going to make today as part of our pledge to drain the swamp. If I'm elected president, I will push for a constitutional amendment to impose term limits on all members of Congress. They've been talking about that for years. Decades of failure in Washington and decades of special interest dealing must and will come to an end.
Representative, you know, with an endorsement like that from the soon-to-be president, why aren't we seeing even more of a push on the term limits front in Missouri and across the country, for that matter?
Well, I'm not really sure, but you know, we did pass a bill last year, a Senate concurrent resolution, on the last day of the session. But it did include the term limits, but it also included two other issues, a balanced budget and a kind of limit on powers of the federal government. But this same resolution I filed was also on the calendar, but we ran out of time before they could bring it up for a vote. So anyway, the people that are supporting this, including myself, are wanting to put this as a standalone issue in the Article 5 process. So mm-hmm. it's as you mentioned, it's in the works, so it looks like it's gaining some traction.
The Article 5 process, representative meeting, going to a constitutional convention.
Yes, that is correct.
Professor Squire, why aren't we seeing, hearing more about term limits these days? It seems like a number of years ago that was in the news regularly, maybe not quite as much these days.
It's not. It was a big issue in the early 1990s. There were attempts in some states to try to impose term limits on members of Congress. That was ruled unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court, which is why any attempt to impose them now has to go through a constitutional amendment process. And we've seen this sort of efforts to try to further impose term limits, even at the state level, has run out of steam over the last decade and a half. And in fact, in recent years, Arkansas and California have both changed their term limit process. They didn't remove them, but they made them a little bit more flexible for the members. And so we're not sure, given the experience that we've had at the state level with term limits, whether it's actually a very good idea to impose on the national level.
Because what the results at the state level, Professor, have been what, so mixed or so hard to track? Because even as somebody who's covered politics in Missouri for a long time, both pre-term limits and post-term limits, I mean, the differences, the distinctions between the two, even for me, are a little hard to tell sometimes.
Well, there are some former members of the legislature who are probably more comfortable talking about this, and there's have reservations about it because, of course, when you impose term limits, you artificially remove people with experience from the legislature. And in the gap that forms there, it tends to shift power away from the legislature into the executive and to interest groups, those parts of the government that tend to have greater continuity and greater informational resources. And so in the long run, it weakens the legislature, and it may make it more difficult for the legislature to play its proper role.
Representative Basie, what about that, what Professor Squire just said?
Well, it was a very good point. And just in our Missouri General Assembly, next year we're going to lose, due to term limits and a few other minor things, people not running again or possibly losing an election, we're going to lose over 40% of the General Assembly and in the House. So it's a big turnover is on the way in the Missouri House due to term limits that we have here in Missouri.
Well, and do you worry about that loss of experience, Representative, as someone who's pushing this idea at the national level so much?
Well, I do. It's going to, you know, you have to make connections with a lot of new people, but this is something that my constituents are feel very strongly about, so I think it's the right thing to do. And, you know, there's good and bad to it. I was a big supporter of term limits when it was put on the ballot here in Missouri. But now that I'm down there, like the professor said, you do see a different side of it. It does give the state departments a lot of power and certain lobbyist groups, so they can just wait you out. But my constituents are the driver of this. They like it, and so that's why I filed the bill.
Representative, ultimately, the reason for term limits is what? What happens to any one lawmaker who stays around for a number of years? What do they change? Do they get what happens that makes these term limits so important in your estimation?
That was a question for me?
Yes, please.
Oh, well, it's some people, I guess, especially on the national level, you hear it about it all the time. They lose connections with their constituents back in their home district, and the people just don't feel they're being listened to, I guess. But a little different here in Missouri. We all return to our district, you know, once every week, and we're only in session from January till May. So, but anyway, that's what I'm hearing about, and on the national level, that people just think that they're not being heard or listened to they feel they should be. So,
Professor Peverell Squire, you know, given all the hubbub about term limits any number of years ago, I was surprised when I looked up last night in getting ready for the show. Just 15 states these days have term limits for state lawmakers now around the country in the 50 states. I was surprised the number's so low.
Well, they're found in places where voters have the initiative process, and almost all of them were imposed by the voters. You'd have to look very hard and long to find any term limits that have been imposed by lawmakers themselves. And in fact, the case that does exist in Louisiana, they have by far the least stringent term limits. And so there's a clear difference between practitioners, or lawmakers themselves, who are reluctant to impose term limits, and voters who, because of their frustration with the political process for a wide range of reasons, seize on term limits as one possible solution.
Mm-hmm. Let me get our listeners involved here. If you want to join our conversation with your thoughts on term limits at the congressional level for the U.S. Senate, for the U.S. House, we don't have them right now. Is it time to change that? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Professor Squire, we're about to talk about the process that would have to be followed to achieve term limits at the congressional level in Washington. Before we do that, how likely is it that we'll ever wind up seeing congressional term limits in this country?
It's a long shot at best. It's a very arduous process to get an amendment through the Constitution. Right now, given the way the country is polarized, it's unlikely that you would have a sufficient number of states that would express interest in calling a convention or even passing any amendment through the legislative process. And so it takes an awful lot of time and effort, and it's not clear that there's any one issue that can really motivate people to run the full gauntlet of obstacles that have to be overcome.
You're scaling a tall mountain here, Representative. A story in the Washington Post a couple of years ago carried this headline: "Sorry, Donald Trump, term limits for Congress are probably never, ever going to happen." Do you buy that?
Well, it's like the professor said, it's going to be tough. I think there's only two states that have passed the standalone term limit resolution so far. But there's a lot that are being pushed. There's other states that they're trying to do the same thing we're doing here in Missouri.
So. And the two states, Representative, are which ones? It's Alabama and
Florida, I believe.
And Florida, that sounds right. And how many do you need to try to open up a national constitutional convention?
We're going to need to get 2/3 on board.
2/3, so a long road ahead to get that done. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
And then the other issue, if I can just add this. We have a sunset on our language that in 5 years, if this doesn't take place, we're going to have to pass the same measure again. So there's another obstacle there but that was necessary to get it through the committee process. A couple of representatives were insistent that we put the sunset language in there 5 years out.
Okay. Lots of people, maybe not surprisingly, want to talk about term limits for members of Congress. Let's go to some calls now. Jan from Belton. Jan, you're on Up to Date. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about the legality or the constitutionality of term limits. Seems like people think of term limits as a good way to get new blood in, but if you think about it, people are voting for their own congressman, and research shows people like their own congressman but don't like somebody else's. So the reason they want term limits, for example, would be to stop McCain from having another term, but that's somebody else's congressman. So what a term limit does, it seems to me, is let somebody else determine your congressman. So is that even legal?
Professor, take a shot at that if you would.
Well, it has to be done by constitutional amendment. So if you amend the Constitution, by definition, that makes it constitutional. And again, it's a long process to get to that point, and it's not clear whether, in fact, if we call a constitutional convention for a single issue, whether that convention would actually be constrained to a single issue. So there's a lot of uncertainty that surrounds this, but if we do amend the Constitution, that will make it in every sense legal.
So you're saying, Professor, if we call this convention, that the range of issues on the agenda could be rather sprawling?
We run that risk. We really don't know. The real experience we have with it, of course, is the original Constitutional Convention, which went well beyond the bounds of what had been intended when it was called. And so we don't know what's going to happen, and I think it's just simply that uncertainty. Nobody can say with any confidence whether, in fact, you could restrict a constitutional convention to a particular issue. And I think that's probably one of the big reasons people will be reluctant if it ever becomes more possible than it appears to be at this point.
Representative Chuck Basie, is that a concern to you?
In some regards, but, you know, that's from the way it's been described to me, it would only take 13, if we do get to this stage where we have a convention, it'll only take 13 states to end it. So, because it takes, Professor, you might correct me if I'm wrong, but 37 states to ratify this and the end result. So, but going back to Jan's point, the opposition, when we were going through the testimony in the committee, they said that we, in essence, we already have term limits in place, and that's the election. So if you don't like what your congressional person is doing, you can vote them out. So, but that was part of the argument against it.
Okay. I hope that helps. Let's go back to some calls. And Holly from Kansas City, Missouri. Holly, you're on Up to Date.
Yes, my daughter Eden has been serving as a legislative aide in Ohio in the State House, and the thing she's commented on is the term limits there have, in essence, just put the lobbyists in complete control. And so the kind of lobbyists, dark money, that problem, I think unintentionally, is just they're the ones with power because the state reps and state senators are there so briefly, and before they can really get it, the lobbyists are just, that's who everybody looks to just do it all. So been a real problem there.
Okay, Holly. Thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Let's go to Carol from Kansas City, Missouri. Carol, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about federal term limits and whether they're needed or not. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm just wondering if campaign finance reform, publicly funded elections, would do more to get elected officials to listen to their constituents rather than the special interest groups.
Professor?
Well, there's certainly good arguments to be made that there are needed reforms in campaign finance and that they would influence the behavior of lawmakers. I think term limits, again, is a response from the public that's frustrated with their political system. And it's one that generates a lot of support. You tend to get a little less support when you start talking about campaign finance reform. But again, it's something that it would have to be looked at, and it does influence the way lawmakers tend to set their agendas.
Let's go to a caller who's not for term limits, and that's Dick from Overland Park. Dick, you're on the air.
Thank you. I'm very much opposed to term limits. I think it's a cop-out on the part of citizens. And I think the real question is, what can we do to help citizens understand what their representatives are doing so that they can make informed decisions at election time, rather than just saying, well, they've been there so long, get rid of the experience?
Well, here at Up to Date, Dick, we're trying. Representative Basie, what would you say in response to Dick here?
Well, he made a good point, but, you know, every district is different. You know, when I ran for re-election this last time, leading up to the election, I think 3 months out, there were, I think, 12 or 13 candidate forums that myself and my opponent participated in. And, you know, in the Columbia area, you have a media market that makes it a little more expensive to be involved in this. But just look at the fellow that's just west of me, Dave Munsell in District 48. I don't think he had any forum. So it is a problem, but, you know, we do have a lot of publicity here that we have available here in the Columbia area and because of the media market. So I think, I don't know, it's a good question, but I don't know if that was a good answer for the caller or not. But.
Let me grab one more call here. Larry from Lawrence. Larry, good morning.
Good morning. I'm for term limits and campaign funding limits. When you try and get hold of established politicians like our senators to Washington, I recently, over the DeVos campaign, put 132 phone calls. And not only could I not get to a voicemail box, but all their voicemail boxes were full. And I feel like they're not listening anymore, and our system is broken. And then it just costs too much for a good person to get into office without being backed by big business.
Okay. I appreciate the phone call, Larry. Thanks for the sentiments. We're going to have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Missouri State Representative Chuck Basie from Rocheport for coming on today, and Peverell Squire, a political scientist over at the University of Missouri. Thank you both for a great conversation. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve.
My pleasure.
Coming up, time for a break, but then we'll visit with Bob Bernier, who wears more hats than almost anybody in the metro. We'll find out how he juggles it all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we spoke to Grammy Award-winning opera singer Joyce DiDonato about returning home to Kansas City this weekend. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date, where you can find all of our podcasts, our episodes in podcast form. On Monday's program, we'll look at toxic stress in children and how it can help them long-term and hurt them as well. That's Monday on Up to Date. Well, Bank of Blue Valley founder Bob Bernier is one of those members of the community who seems to have done it all. His list of positions held and honors won is long and sweeping. He's a former Kansas Cityan of the Year. He's a former board chairman of the Greater Kansas City Chamber of Commerce. He's chaired the Union Station Board. His family endowed the Bernier Institute of Entrepreneurship and Innovation at the Block School of Management at UMKC. He's chaired the Johnson County Community College Foundation, and he was a founding board member of the Reach Foundation. And by the way, he's also helping KCUR. It turns out that his family has deep roots in Johnson County that go back decades. Given all that, we figured it was time to sit down for a chat with Bob Bernier. And welcome. So good to have you, Bob.
Thank you very much. You bet. Pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start with the latest news. The Senate just passed some major revisions to the Dodd-Frank law that was originally passed in the wake of the financial meltdown in 2008. I'm guessing here that you think this was a positive move, and I'm wondering why.
Yes, it definitely gets a positive move. It's time to roll back some of those things. I mean, during the financial
because you were directly affected, I'm sure you
absolutely
were
directly yeah. affected, and during the financial crisis, there was a pretty pressing need, or there was a professing feeling that we needed to do some things to correct the excesses in the financial system, and as is the case with a lot of these things, the pendulum swung too far. I think that a lot of what was impacted with that was enacted with Dodd-Frank really hurt the economy and delayed the impact or the recovery of the from the recession.
And it slowed down the work you do out at your bank?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, one specific thing that and it's something that's very close to us. We were a very big lender in the mortgage lending space and the housing, I think, is an incredibly important factor in our society. I think it builds stability and builds home ownership is really a stabilizing influence, and it really had a significant impact. In fact, caused our bank to get out of that business because it was wow. just too tough to remain compliant and do all the rules and frankly, it's a fast moving area, and we just opted to get out of that business.
And you had to turn some people down who maybe otherwise might have qualified or should have qualified.
Absolutely, your editorial in the paper kind of reminded me this morning. It reminded me of a story that I had. One of my best customers was trying to help their child get a house and came in and said, this is what I want to do. And I said, sure, no problem. Great customer, great balance sheet, great. This is a really credible customer. And so I went to my fellow that does that and I said, this is what we're going to do. And he says, you can't do that. And I said, I don't understand what you mean. And he said, well, under the rules, you cannot help this fellow construct a home for his kids because, you know, it doesn't fall within certain criteria and certain wow. and certain ratios. Wow. And in the end result, which is really fascinating, I said, I've got to help this guy out. I loaned him the money unsecured. I couldn't take a mortgage because it would have been in violation of the rules.
Wow. Let's turn to your bank, the Bank of Blue Valley, Bob. Did you really start that thing in a double-wide trailer?
Absolutely, a little double-wide mobile home.
Who'd want to come out and do business with you in a double-wide trailer?
Well, you
look like a nice guy, but I'm not sure I would have wanted
well,
to do
you
that.
Know, one of my best friends, actually the guy that was across the street from me, and, you know, we were good friends. We saw each other all the time. We partied together. We did a lot of – our kids grew up together, and he told me one day we were talking, and I don't press my friends for business necessarily. He said, you know, Bob, as soon as you're in that building, I'm going to open up an account with you. And I thought, oh my gosh, at that point in time, I needed you when I was growing the bank to try to get right. to a building. But anyway, it was actually a great environment to start a bank because you could not walk in that bank. I saw every customer that came in and out of the front door of that bank.
So you said you started that bank out of necessity. Why?
Well, I was working for Boatman's at the time. I've been with
downtown,
Boatman, downtown, and been there 19 years. Had a great job. Had a good boss. The Boatman's was going through some changes at that point in time. There was some new leadership there. As the leadership came in, they said, Bob, you're a lender, you're a new business development guy, you're in charge of operations, you're in charge of administration, you do a lot of different things. But and many of those people we got working for us do new business development and lending. Nobody has the breadth of the administrative skills that you did. We want you to just do that. And I said, I do that because I'm good at that. But I said, the other stuff is the fun stuff. I mean, when I come to work, I like to talk to customers. I like the challenge of trying to sell the bank. And I said, you take that away. You're taking away the best part of my job. Hmm. And I thought about it. We talked about it some more. And I just went back a week or so later and I said, look, you got too many executives. This is a chance for you to reduce one of those. And one of my good friends, a person that was probably on the list to be cut, came up, gave me a big hug. He said, you saved my job. I'm getting your position.
And so out to the double wide trailer you went.
Right.
Why banking in your life? What was it about banking that drew you as powerfully as it appears to have drawn
you?
Well,
actually, it wasn't a natural thing. When I graduated from K-State, I really always intended to go to work for my dad, and because he had a pretty substantive business, and came home, and the next day I go to work with my dad, and my dad was in the real estate business, but he did a lot of construction, and I was down in a ditch just digging away with a shovel, and did that day, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and after about a couple of weeks, I came up to my dad. I said, Dad, I didn't go to college to dig ditches. And my dad said, Bob, you don't do that very well. So as soon as you perfect that, maybe we'll move you up. Yeah. And I said, I just have to do something else. And so I looked around. I actually went to work as a welder for a good friend of mine for about 3 months. And then, I found an opportunity with the old Baltimore Bank is what it was called back then, and got started with them and enjoyed it. But, when Ted McCarter came and joined the bank as the new CEO, he really he gave me some additional responsibilities, and I started to really, really enjoy it.
Civic leader Bob Rainier is my guest. Tell us a little more about your father, Victor, who helped really establish Johnson County as one of the premier, suburban enclaves in the country. How did he wind up here? And tell us a little more about what he did, because he was a significant person.
He was a tremendous individual and a tremendous mentor for me. I mean, my father, he's the one that instilled the work ethic in all three of his children. But he, grew up in Kansas City, born over in Wyandotte County, from in a very, very poor environment. I mean, they moved during the recession probably 10 or 12 times because they just could not pay their rent. But ended up going into the Navy during the war. And when he came back from the war, he was a licensed electrician before leaving, and decided he was going to go into the construction business. His dad was a carpenter, and so he started building houses right after the war. And as a matter of fact, the interesting thing that if you're ever over at Casey Joe's over there, the old Casey Joe's at 47th and Mission Road.
That's right where I live. That's my neighborhood.
Is that right? Okay, so you go one block north of that on the west side is a little subdivision, and a little sign says Missiondale. That was my dad's very first subdivision.
No kidding.
He did that in like 91 and 92. The houses were $9,855, and it won that year an award for some of the best post-war housing in the United States. So that was his start.
He would become one of the county's largest landowners. I mean, he was quite significant.
He started there, and it just moved south and went to Reinhardt Estates, and then Leavitt Hills West, and just kept going south. And as he got further south, he was having a difficult time selling houses because there weren't any services. So he built the Ranch Mart Shopping Center, and at that point in time, got his real taste for commercial development, and then started looking for land further south. And he was a substantive landowner.
It was farm fields back in those days.
Oh, absolutely.
Right, this is what we're talking about, right?
No, he would buy that the 135th and 169 highway, there's a huge development there. He owned 160 acres there, and that's all developed now into shopping centers and restaurants and everything else. So.
Bank of Blue Valley founder Bob Rainier is my guest. I'm wondering what your dad would make of Johnson County today. How long ago did he pass?
He passed in 2000. So
you wonder what he'd think about it today.
I don't know. You know, he always believed in Johnson County. He just knew that it was the right place. I mean, he grew up in Wyandotte County, and frankly, some of the issues that Wyandotte County had back in the old days was, you know, a lot of insiders and dare say corruption and just things. This was back in the 50s. He just didn't see that in Johnson County. He saw it as the great opportunity for him, and he just always believed the more he saw, the more he says, he'd buy every acre in Johnson County if he could afford to do that, and he just believed in the county, and it treated him very well.
But again, the county of your father's time, Johnson County is different today. It's changing.
It is.
And it's changing in some ways rather quickly.
Yes.
What do you make of it?
Well, I'm still optimistic about that. I think that you've got great leadership at the county level and at the city level.
And that's changing too.
That is changing.
I mean, your generation is passing on, moving
right.
on.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, that's maybe a little bit of a yet to come, as far as the future leadership. Some of the current guys like Ed Eilert and Carl Gerlach, I mean, really substantive individuals that really are professional and really looking out for the best interest of Johnson County. But it is changing, and it's becoming more diverse, and we have to embrace that. I'm involved with a group called Forward OP that is trying to establish what we want Overland Park to be in the future, and it's a really nice program. I'm impressed by the fact that the city is really thinking about that, trying to be very conscious about the direction they go and things that they need to do in order to be the best that they can be.
I mean, you hear this word poverty attached to Johnson County now in different pockets of the county, not widespread in a major way, but you never heard that word attached to it back in the day.
No, absolutely not. And it is Johnson County is diverse economically as well. I mean, there are pockets, in different cities within the county that we really need to pay attention to, and we need to reinvest in those areas. It's becoming a much more diverse county. You look at particularly the Shawnee Mission School District. I mean, they have had a number of obstacles to overcome relative to language and just the diversity of their population. And I think, by the way, they've done a great job. But it's going to be more difficult. Everything's more difficult today than it used to be.
Are there two or three things that, as you look across your time in Johnson County and where it is today, what you think need to happen to keep this thing going?
Well, I think we've got to have a good overall supervision and management by the elected officials, and I think we've got that. I think they have to be careful about development. I mean, I'm still in the real estate business myself, but we've got to allow development to happen, because I think that's what brings additional economic value to Johnson County, and also will increase our population base and will bring people to Johnson County.
Mm-hmm.
I'm particularly concerned about housing. Johnson County was the place that a lot of young people went, and you could get, up until the recession, a new house in the 225 to 275 range, and that's just becoming more and more difficult. You have to go further and further out to get that accomplished, and you look at some of the statistics, and we've got this sort of, well, I see it as a collision coming in the next year or two, because the supply of housing is not in sync with the demand for housing.
That's interesting.
It's going to be a real problem. I mean, there's literally at this point in time, when the 200,000 and under, probably 250 and under range, there's less than a 2-week supply of housing. It's just really, it's going to push prices up. And I do believe that housing is really very important. I mean, it is a stabilizing influence. It's been what Johnson County has always been.
You know, there's been this criticism of Johnson County, as a place that, enjoys the museums and the sports teams that are on the Missouri side of the state line. But Johnson County has been spared the expense of paying for it all. What about that? Is that fair criticism? I mean, is there enough interplay between Johnson County and Jackson County and the city of Kansas City, Missouri? Or is that something that we need to work on?
That's something we need to work on. I mean, it's starting. There's a program called Core Four that is the I think it's Jackson County, Johnson County, Kansas City, Missouri, and Wyandotte County. And the unified government, and they've got together to talk about things that they have in common. I think that's a great first step, and I think that was, you know, it was Hannes Zacharias and Troy were kind of the leaders of that.
Troy Schulte, the city manager of Kansas City, Hannes, the former city manager in out in Johnson County.
Right. Yeah. So I think that's a good first start. You know, it is. You know, there it goes. Kind of both ways. I do believe Johnson County needs to be more ingrained. I've always said that Johnson County, without the Nelson Art Gallery, without the sports teams, without the international airport, without all of those, you know, without the Kauffman, it's like Cleveland on a bad day. I mean, it's a bad thing. I mean, we just don't have those amenities make us full. Now, we've got the Nerman. We've got a lot of great things. We've got Johnson County Community College. We've got some tremendous assets. But, you know, we really are. When I go someplace, I usually don't say I live in Leawood or I work in Overland Park. I say I'm from Kansas City.
Yeah, but critics say that Johnson County just doesn't participate in the financing of some of the jewels of the metropolitan area.
Well, and that is true. And that is something that, you know, there was a discussion, and I was involved in that discussion in a very minor way, about trying to create, a district that might be a metropolitan district for transportation. Now, having said that, Kansas City, Missouri owns the airport. Do they want to give up control of their property to people from Johnson County, or at least have them participate in some of those decisions?
The struggles have gone back and forth.
Exactly.
I'm well aware of that on both sides of the state line.
Right.
Everybody's
Absolutely.
Sort of controlling their turf here.
Right. But the bottom line is, we need the best international airport for everyone. And I applaud the city and I applaud the airport authority to reaching out to Johnson County to get their input on the new airport. That new airport is incredibly important to our economy in Kansas City for all of us. And so I applaud them for that. How that happens, we need to keep working on that. The bi-state authority that helped create Union Station or save Union Station was incredibly important. I'm not sure that could be done again because of the legislatures in both Missouri and Kansas, maybe primarily Kansas. But
perhaps there might be room for another one for the right cause down the road, in your mind?
I would hope, because because the things that we have that we should cherish, and the things that we should expand, and the things that we should work on are really, citywide. They don't stop at the state line.
Civic leader Bob Bernier is my guest. You know, I got to ask, you know, you do all these things, and I knew you were busy. I mentioned this to you before the show. I knew you were busy. I didn't realize how involved you were in so many things. So how do you keep track of all this stuff, and what's your schedule look like every day?
Well, I do a lot of things. I couldn't do this without a... I've got a wife that's incredibly flexible, and I don't have any kids at home. So, I mean, those two things give me a little bit more time. But, you know, good electronic calendar I promised my wife that she wouldn't have to go to another Chamber of Commerce dinner. She didn't have to. She didn't want to. I mean, so I take my daughter to the Greater Kansas City Chamber dinner, but I go to five Chamber dinners every year and the annual dinner. So it's you just schedule it and every once in a while you step back and say, you maybe shed a few things and because always there's always another opportunity out there of somebody that's at your door saying, can you help me with this?
Former Senate President, Kansas Senate President Dick Bond once said of you, hey, Bob Bernier does a whole lot of things well, but, you know, he just can't say no.
That's fair. I mean, and I'm working on that. I got to be better at that.
That's an area of improvement down the road here.
You know, the case we mentioned, KCRR, you know, that was one on their annual event. I told my wife, I said, I really don't have time to do that. And my wife says, Bob, it's the only radio station you ever listen to. You never listen to any other station. I used to have radio. I paid for radio on other stations that I never listened to as advertising for the bank. KCR was very important to me, and she said, if it's that important, we ought to get involved, and so we did.
You know, one of the places that has your name on it, the Rainier Institute of Entrepreneurship and Innovation at the Block School here at UMKC, what's its focus, and why did you engage there?
You know, that the we always looked at my dad and the money that we are fortunate enough to be able to contribute to various causes. This all came from my dad's estate. And my dad was an entrepreneur. He was a guy that just got up every day and worked incredibly hard. He had a work ethic that was with unmatched anywhere that I ever saw. But I, you know, at UMKC, I went to K-State, but I got my master's degree
That's
at
right.
UMKC, so I had a connection down there, and I liked the people down at UMKC. But, you know, one of many things that got us engaged there was Henry Block. You know, when Henry became more involved with the Block School and the business school down there, it became even a more important thing for us. Henry Block is an absolutely unique individual, as we all know. He's a guy that not only was incredibly smart and incredibly successful, but he's a tremendous human being.
Yeah,
I mean, this
no
guy
question.
Is a solid, you know, a solid character and solid individual. So.
Well, Bob Bernier, founder of Bank of Blue Valley, who does so many things in the Metro, thanks for your time today. Thanks for the good conversation.
I appreciate it.
Monday on the show, we'll find out how stress and trauma in childhood can last a whole lot longer than that. Our theme music is composed by Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Chris Brewitt, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.